Welcome to Hormone Health Podcast, brought to you by Georgia Hartman and Chloe Sheehan.
This podcast is an extension of Hormone Health Studio, which is our naturopathic clinic based here in Newcastle and online.
We're just two naturopaths who love a laugh, coffee, croissants, and conversations about real people with real health concerns.
Nothing's off limits. We're here to educate you on what's happening in your body, share emerging research, and debunk buried health misconceptions.
So sit back and let us do the talking.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Rhea. As someone who has been in the industry for decades, can you share a bit about your journey as a birth attendant and everything else that you have accomplished in this time?
Good. Hello, Georgia. So beautiful to be with you and to be speaking to whoever is out there and who might be listening. Thanks for the opportunity. So my first daughter, three daughters I have, and the first was born in England back in the late 70s, and at one of the big large teaching hospitals in London. And I was led to believe by the very, you know, some classes that they put on that, of course, at that point we talked about natural birth. That was the sort of language that was used, natural birth, and it mainly talked about, you know, not using drugs. The other thing that was happening then, of course, normal physiological childbirth wasn't really, that language wasn't used, because pretty much births were normal physiological childbirth with or without drugs. So that's a bit hard for people to get their heads around now. So anyway, I was going for a natural birth. The hospital, in the classes that they, the minor bits of classes that they were giving, which were more like lectures with like 100 of us in the room or something, I asked a particular question because I'd heard a bit about episiotomies and didn't think I would like to have one of those. So I asked this question, and the obstetrician who was giving the lecture said, "Oh, no, we don't do." I asked, you know, "Are they done routinely?" And no, we don't do them routinely. We only do them absolutely if they're necessary. So I was reassured. And anyway, I mean, I don't know, sometimes maybe Georgia, if you're the people who are listening, I've written much more detail about that darling daughter of mine's birth, because really that was the start of a radicalization for me about birth. And it happened on day one after she was born. She's born early in the morning. Later on that afternoon, when I was up in the, she was in the nursery, I was in the 12-bed ward, as they were then, with, you know, you might, well, if you think, if those of you watching, you know, Call the Midwife and the room, so it's a bed with a curtain around it. And so on that ward, there were 10 of us in this open bed ward with, and we would put the curtains around us whenever we were breastfeeding. That was how it worked. Otherwise, our babies were kept in the nursery apart from if we were breastfeeding them. And so there was lots of time there where just all of us women who just had our baby were chatting across the, you know, talking with one another. Mm. On that ward, there were also two other beds that were a bit more, they had a partition around them. And I found out late on this afternoon after the first, when my baby was born, because I'd had an episiotomy and so on. And so I just asked, remember, I got in my mind that, oh, no, they only do them when they're absolutely necessary. So I'm thinking, well, I wonder what was wrong with me that I would need one. So I just was asking that question. Anyway, in that, of the 10 women in this open part of the ward, all of us had had episiotomies. Wow. And the other two had had Caesars. So I thought to myself, what the fuck is going on? So that was the point of my radicalization. And then a few other things happened, and I just got that daughter of mine and got the hell out of there. And that started to shape something for me. It was like, okay, what we're being told isn't necessary. What's happening? What is going on? I was very lucky then. I mean, I'm Australian. My husband at that point was, so he's from England. That's how come we're over there having that baby. Came back here to Australia, and with good luck, very good luck, had there are one or two birth centres started here in Melbourne, one in particular. So a birth centre, plus there was a home birth, a small home birth scene. And back at that time, the home births, well, certainly in Victoria, where I'm from, I think probably more widely across Australia, midwives weren't involved in home births. It was the GP obstetricians. So GP obstetricians who stepped outside of their sort of medical constraints, if you like, and opened into home births. That was certainly how it was here in Melbourne. And so I just somehow, or other, by good luck, tapped in here. And so then with my second and third baby, home births with the GP obstetrician and, well, basically family. So at that point, trained midwives weren't working in the first place with the GP obstetricians. That changed. A number of medically trained midwives or came out of the hospitals and started to work with the GP obstetricians, because that was, and this would be a whole other story to talk about some of the political action that we all did to really make that change, so that midwives in their own right could, as we have practicing now, be doing home births without that the GP obstetricians. Although I think in some really remote areas, country areas, maybe there are still some GP obstetricians who are doing that work, which is a brilliant way of going about it as well. So at that point, and at that point also, there was no such, the word existed, of course, because it comes out of the Greek language, but there was no such role as a doula. That didn't exist at that point. So in fact, it was the GP obstetrician and more or less the family, or for our second baby, the first home birth. This is late 70s. They were just big parties. We must have had 12 or so people at that. There were friends, there were toddlers, there was a toddler, a woman who's came to look after my toddler, of course, brought her two kids and then the neighbor. Anyway, it was party, party, party.
Wow, that is fascinating. I just picture flares and, you know.
Yeah. So anyway, fantastic, beautiful birth. When I mean, I don't know, even in that space, when she was born, I was very internally attuned, and very much focused. My eyes were down, looking at her coming and looking at, and after she was born, maybe 5 minutes after, just drawing my eyes away from her and what was going on, I looked up and all of the, like there's 10 people just standing around quietly, just in awe watching. So those were the
Phenomenal.
days. Anyway, by the time the things shifted a little bit, by the time another 2 years later, when we had our third baby, second home birth. And I mean, maybe it's gets good to say this, because the home birth midwives now, they're under a lot of scrutiny and often given really a hard time. So back then, before the midwives came in, before those political and sort of changes happened, of course, pretty much the GP obstetricians who were doing home births were under the scrutiny. And at the point that I had my third baby, second home birth, the GP obstetrician I'd had for my first home birth had been, he was under the pump in terms of all of the regulations, and he wasn't able to be at the birth. So another GP had stepped up, who eventually also, maybe these histories have to be written. Anyway, that thing about stepping outside of a particular mold and starting to change things up, lots of political action for me being involved in that in terms of my baby, so radicalized around that. And then it's like, particularly not home birth scene then, if you'd had a home birth, well then you're an expert. And so then if there are other women around who could be friends or neighbors or just part of that sort of network, that loose, smallish network. Oh, well, you come to my birthday or birth, or of course, and it was often women having their second baby, so there's a toddler around. And so actually, when I was pregnant with my second baby before her birth, I was at the birth of three other birth because I was there supposedly looking after the toddler. But you know what happens with those second babies if it's been a vaginal birth the first time?
Tell me.
They just jump out.
Unfortunately, mine didn't, but I'm
I
hoping my
know.
third will.
Yes.
A sneeze, I'm hoping a little sneeze, and it'll be
No,
all
it's not quite that easy. But
done.
just that whole thing that they don't muck around, they come quite. So, one or two, I think that first birth, somebody had to catch the baby. The GP obstetrician didn't get there, got there a bit later. So, it happened to be me. So, just that grassroots, sister to sister, being in that space. And I've come to talk about it, and probably write about it too. I think that it was more Sheila Kitson, that brilliant, powerful, wonderfully robust childbirth educator, and wrote so many books about birth. I met her quite a number of times, and she talked about that in much earlier eras. To be present at a birth for a woman who was already a mother, to be present at a birth was sort of like an expected part of sort of housekeeping, homemaking, community making, to not so much in terms of the medical role, but to know how to be at a birth to offer support either to the woman or to the space or the language that we might use now. So it was seen more, I think, in terms of neighborhood or community service. It certainly wasn't, as it's now become, when we talk about now doulas, and that's a business. And that's a big change in my lifetime. And that also sits on top of and within a whole big social change in terms of mums and mums at home and needing to work or choosing to work, or that they have skills, and so that idea of having business, and that's a different world to the one that I came into birth with. And so it wasn't till much, much later that the word doula came in. I keep trying to track this, late 80s, I think, maybe, coming out of America. And even when it first came, it was a particular role of birth support rather than, as it's now really moving into, this whole arena of doula business, which is necessary, and it's a way forward in a whole lot of ways for those of us passionate about birth and what that might look like. So anyway, I could go on and on, but it's probably
This is what happens when
maybe.
you've seen the industry evolve over years and years. And look, I think a big point that you're making is that birth culture is not necessarily set up to support us. Perhaps it has been at some stages and it's changed, or perhaps we're still really trying to support women to have these normal physiological births where possible. And I think there's a lot of fear. Like, we certainly see it in our clinical practice. We often see a lot of women and couples who've experienced recurrent pregnancy loss. And so, of course, once they finally have pregnancy after loss, there is a lot of fear and a lack of control. And that carries on throughout pregnancy and into labor and into birth. And I think there's a lot of fear around pain in particular. So I would love to know, what's your view on pain? I know you have different terms for different types of pain. Can you share a little bit about that for our listeners?
It's one of my favorite topics, really. So the background, though, to say about this is that, again, I came into birth to have my babies. I was a physical education teacher and outdoor adventures sort of facilitator. So doing that sort of work, but as well as an athlete and sports person and what have you. So before I had my own babies, and then when I was working in birth, particularly in the home birth scene, it was really coming at that idea of pain in labor as just the sort of functional pain, but different qualities to it, of course, at different times, but functional pain of our bodies working. This is a healthy body doing a healthy and pretty momentous thing, and that process of opening and so on was a part of the functions of the body, just not exactly like in terms of the sensations, although oftentimes similar. But just like other achievements with the body, if we're wanting to be an athlete or swim or run or what have you, then there's or a yoga class or a gym class or weights, whatever all the things are, that has functional physiological pain that goes with it, with stretch receptors going crazy, with muscles tightening and releasing and breath and all of that stuff. So that's the way I came at birth, and certainly has always been the way that I've been working and understanding birth because of that background. And also, I guess, because luckily immersed in the home birth scene and seeing all of that happen in that way. So that functional physiological pain for some women, and again, this became we could see this much more clearly in the home birth scene, because we were not in a medical frame, but for some women, that functional physiological pain may be impacted by psychological pain, by life stories or life present situations or traumas, past traumas, or whatever that can be locked in the body or can be in a birth process, can be, I usually talk about, you can do 10 years of therapy in 10 minutes in a labor if you've got good support around you. So sometimes that psychological layering of life story on top of the functional physiological pain. And of course, many people who are athletes or we hear these stories of people, that they've got to really work with their psychological stuff because it's limiting to their trust in their bodies or limiting. So same with birth. So that can add another layer about pain in labor. But to be, so if that would be beautiful if we just could understand it, that functional physiological pain may be exacerbated or intensified, or of course sweetened by psychological and life experiences and so on. But of course, what we have done in Western cultures, well, all over now, because we've pretty well applied this everywhere, but we have taken birth out of the home in particular, or the field, or the stream, although wherever, and placed it in hospitals. And so we then got this whole, like in hospitals, brilliant. When there's something going wrong in your body, it's ill health, damage, disease, danger, accident. And in that context, in hospitals, with that and the pain that comes from damage, disease, and illness, and so on, then how brilliant to be able to have pain relief that relates to easing the situation so that the healing, there's more energy for healing. So that's what hospitals promise and offer. But we've placed birth into that context as a social norm. And pretty much certainly the Western world, but probably pretty everywhere. So then that's what we do. So that thing of, occasionally in small numbers, there are some births that really are not going well, not going straightforwardly, and the pain then might be considered to be pathological pain. But generally, this is not the case. Generally, it's that we have in our mindset this idea about hospitals, about pain. Pain is pathological because it's about damage and disease and injury. And so then when we're in pain in labor, then that can push all that fear, those fear factors and so on, which then makes it just goes round even more. So apart from, I talk a lot about, if you're not going to have a home birth, and some people, it's not what they want, or of course there are small numbers of women where they need everything that we can give them, and their babies need everything we can give them to keep them and themselves and their baby safe and well. Brilliant. But in terms of the numbers, no. It's a whole other hijacking. But I think that if we weren't going to give birth at home, if we thought about that births happen in yoga studios, or that births happened in, well, at the weights room at the gym, or that they happened, I don't know, places where we ex or in the spin class, where you'd be expecting that you're working with functional physiological pain. It's getting more intense. And in fact, that getting more intense means that the whole physical fitness situation is getting better and better and better. Just like in birth, if we understand this escalation of the functional physiological pain means that the birth is going better and better and better, so brilliant. So if we could shift that mindset, then that would be a brilliant thing to do. So I write about that a lot in that first book of mine, and also that second book. So it's, have the baby at home, or speak to your yoga teacher and say, "Do you mind if we just, in the middle of the class, but just have that baby over there so that I can just keep my mindset about this is just about functional physiological pain rather than that idea about pain that it, things going wrong."
It's so
In
true. Like,
fact,
I've been doing quite a bit of yoga this pregnancy, and it's
yeah.
hard. You think, the layperson might think about yoga, and this is me quite naively going, great, bit of stretching, it'll be wonderful for me.
Yes.
And now that I'm in the classes, you really, there's a point there where you think, I've just got to hold on here and breathe through it.
Yes,
And
exactly.
it's the, it's, there's certainly a nice relationship, or correlation with that type of pain and the pain that you experience in labor.
Yeah.
Perhaps we could talk about the magic of hormones during labor. And I've heard you previously paint a picture of what happens with hormones like oxytocin and endorphins and that whole process. Can you paint a picture of the hormonal changes that happen during labor?
Georgia, I'm very happy to paint a picture about this, but to paint the full picture, I've got to come out of this gorgeous language that we might use about how birth can be and go to the stats for a little while.
Please.
Because I want to paint the true picture about what women are up against.
Yeah.
Not only women, their partners, but in fact our babies. Maybe just to say, first of all, a little bit, I'm only going to just talk about three. It's much more complex hormonally than what I'm going to talk about. I focus on three of the hormones. Our darling Dr. Sarah Buckley, who, even though she was born in New Zealand, she does her great work here, so we're going to claim her as an Aussie. And
Absolutely.
she is the queen of all things hormonal across the world, actually. Top researcher on hormones. So anybody who wants to go in deeper, please get onto Sarah's work if you're not onto it already. But what, so the three that I want to talk about is oxytocin, endorphins, and adrenaline. And there's a whole dance that goes on with those three hormones. But we have to educate, if we're educating about this, we've got to educate the difference between, because I think in the language and in that I hear, and sadly, a lot of my main education about the birth culture at present is doing birth debriefing. It's not so good. But we hear, yes, oxytocin, oxytocin, oxytocin. They gave me oxytocin. We've got to differentiate between what I call queen oxytocin. And this is endogenous oxytocin. This is the oxytocin that's coming out of the mother's body, the baby's body, and the whole dance that's happening, as well as in beautifully supported situations, the oxytocin that's flowing between the mother and the partner. And, this queen oxytocin, this is what we understand, not only the hormone that drives the contractions, but it's the hormone, it's the love hormone, it's the tend and befriend hormone, it's the friendship hormone, it's the social glue hormone. It's the happy, happy place where we are with one another, where we're just in that beautiful vibe as human beings, social engagement. Or this is our mammalian heritage, queen oxytocin. It's sort of excreted, so it's part of the, I mean, we are drunk on queen oxytocin. Why do you think you get up as a doula or a midwife in the middle of the night and go to thousands of births? We're oxytocin junkies. Does everybody falling in love and falling in love with that baby, that whole thing of that attachment and nurturing and needed connectedness of these small vulnerable babies with their mums and a wider sort of circle. It's not just up to mums, but key person. So this is all queen oxytocin bonding. This is our human mammalian heritage. So there's that queen oxytocin. That's what we're wanting to be driving. And in normal physiological childbirth, yes, queen oxytocin builds and builds and builds. There's other hormones as well, but eventually tip over and then we get the contractions and so on, building, 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 queen oxytocin more and more and more, driving bigger and bigger and stronger contractions and opening the body and so on, queen oxytocin. However, in our birth culture, we use a synthetic form of oxytocin, which is still called, most people just still call oxytocin and think it's the same thing. So apparently it's the same chemical signature, synthetic oxytocin and queen oxytocin. However, queen oxytocin crosses the blood-brain barrier, and this is what makes us fall in love with one another and our babies, and shifts our thinking and shifts our feelings and shift our brain waves and so on. Synthetic oxytocin doesn't do that, and in fact really only works in the body and, yes, can drive contractions. So no doubt many of your listeners have, you know, maybe some of them had inductions or augmentations, and synthetic oxytocin has been used driving the contractions. So this is a big difference. I'm hoping anybody who's listening to this understands this big difference. So I want to now just give the stats, because I want to make another statement about that or discussion. So queen oxytocin is the bonding hormone, a few others that come in play there, but it's a key one. We want to bond with our babies. Our babies need to bond with us. We want our kids to bond with us. We want us all to be in that social engagement where we're all bonding and feeling safe. And I mean, particularly at this particular time in our world at the moment, we could do with a hell of a lot more queen oxytocin and everybody falling in love with one another and being supportive and nurturing. And do I need to keep saying these things? Obviously I do. So we want this. Most of us want this. We want this in our communities where we're tending and befriending and nurturing and caring. It happens in a lot of situations, but birth is a major transmission point for a mother's oxytocin capacity to be transmitted to her baby. Mm. And we want these babies to come out being beautiful, open people who've got lots of oxytocin capacity to be generous and loving and so on in their lives. Yeah. This is what the oxytocin researchers around the world, Sarah being one and Kirsten Moberg being another, this concern about what we're doing in birth at the level of the intervention. So spontaneous onset of labor, that's a queen oxytocin story, yeah? Mm-hmm. Baby feels ready, the baby sends up some signals, not only oxytocin, but others sort of knocking on the mum saying, hey, mum, I'm ready. And the mother, this is like a hormonal story between the two of them. Oh, yeah, darling, I'm ready too. Let's rock and roll. Mm-hmm. So we get going. And then the queen oxytocin is more and more developing labor. Yeah, that's what we want. And then at the end, talk a little bit more. There's a few other steps in there, but at the end, again, queen oxytocin is creating that situation of the mother, deep bonding with the baby and the baby with the mother and everybody else in the room as well. So spontaneous onset of labour. In the last stats, Australian stats, and these ones come from 2021, so we're due for some new ones. It'd be very interesting to, well, I'm pretty sure it'll be worse. But only 41% of babies got to call the shots about their timing, about when they're ready to be born, and start that process of those hormonal processes, particularly queen oxytocin, to get that happening.
Less than half.
Mm. And don't get your hopes up, that don't even stay with feeling that that's hopeful, because of that 41% that at least get a bit of a whiff of queen oxytocin between them, 25% of that 41% are going to go on to be augmented with synthetic oxytocin. And once synthetic oxytocin comes into the picture, queen oxytocin is a shy hormone and she's gone.
Yeah.
I will weep. I weep.
As someone who's experienced a home birth and queen oxytocin in her absolute prime and has also experienced an emergency cesarean, sure, I labored for 24 hours. And so, of course, got a bit of that. But I remember, like, after my son, who was my home birth, was born, I remember pulling him out of the water and going, I did it. Like, I was just like, this is euphoric. It was, and everyone felt it. It was phenomenal. After the cesarean, I had to ask someone to get my mobile phone so that I could text my partner to see, one, where he was and if the baby was okay, all while they're shaking whatever the side effect of, whatever.
Yes.
Waiting to feel my legs again, and I'm thinking, what is this it? Phenomenal, the difference.
Big, big, big difference. So let me go on with these stats that you're putting the color into the drawing that we're doing here. So 41% queen oxytocin, a bit of a whiff. Of that, 25% of that 41% are going to, queen oxytocin is not staying in the picture because of being augmented with synthetic oxytocin. The induction rate, and this is synthetic oxytocin, no queen oxytocin in this story, the induction rate is 34%. And then we have the elective seizure rate, which is 25%, and there is no queen oxytocin in that picture. So in these stats, if we're looking to find where is queen oxytocin, well, so there's a whiff of queen oxytocin for 41% of the babies, the mothers and babies, but not all the way through. I mean, what the fuck are we doing, really?
And what do you think is driving this? Is it fear?
I
Is
think
it in inconvenience? Is it a timing?
there's big systems issues. I mean, the most predictive, you've got to think that mostly birth happens in hospitals, yeah? Big hospitals, small hospital, regional hospitals, country hospitals. This is now where our culture says this is where it should happen, with all the things that that means. Some of them brilliant, some of them not so good. But this is a systems issue. How does a hospital provide, like, the systems required for caring for the mums and the babies to really what is sort of an unpredictable life event? Like, if we're talking about normal physiological childbirth or natural childbirth, we don't exactly know when it's going to get going. We don't exactly know what day, what night, what middle of the night, or whatever. So how does a hospital, it must be for the admin, it must be just a bit of a nightmare about all of that. And I use the example that some years ago here at one of the big hospitals, the Mercy Hospital here, over the Easter, with one of the, like, about 6 years ago, they had something like 74 births in 72 hours
Oh my
on that full
goodness.
moon, that Easter full moon. So what does that mean? So from the point of view of the hospitals, from the po hospital admin and the functioning, would be good if birth was more predictable. Would be much easier to know, but have a bit more staff on here. So how do we make birth more predictable? Well, of course, more predictable if we induce, because we know pretty well how long that's going to go. Or if we do an elective seizure, of course, then that's much more predictable, and so on, so on. So I think that that's a large part of it. And also, I think that there's so much fear mongering about birth anyway now that there are many women who are making that as a social choice, not so much a systems choice, but as a social choice for that. And they're women who are making those choices, they're well served in the present birth culture. The women who are not so well served are women who want to have a go at normal physiological childbirth if they're in the system. I mean, many other factors, but that's my bigger overview about it.
And I mean, it's conversations like this that help people understand, how normal it is to go through the throes of labor. So you've spoken about queen oxytocin. What comes next?
Okay, so queen oxytocin. So queen oxytocin driving those contractions. So we think about, so that here's the childbirth educator in me. Think about, usually I'm drawing this on a whiteboard. But you know, that 1 to 2 centimeters. So this is that really pre and early labor. And ideally for women even having their first baby, that, but this is a bit of a question mark for me now with in contemporary times, but it used to be that, of course, what that felt like for many women's was what their period, what period pain felt like, or what the day before or the full-on day of or whatever. So that early contractions were normalized in a way, or at least having a sense of what you could do with them, you know, the hot water bottle or the or whatever. So that early time, I think that has changed. That's another thing that's changing, that women are not engaging for all sorts of reasons with their, you know, maybe they're straight away on some pain relief or on the pill or what have you, and so they're not necessarily got that rhythm of engagement with those earlier niggles and sensations that the rest of us, or in earlier times, we would have had a possibility of engaging with. So we'd recognize them and think, oh yeah, this is familiar, and be able to have some resources to deal with it, hot water bottle or a bit of a walk or a massage or whatever the things were. So that would generally take us up to that 1 to 3 centimeters or so, because when we did have our period, when women who are listening still are, that cervix has to open a little bit to let that blood out. So some of those sensations, that's what that early labor stuff is like. Then we come up to, we talk about around that 4 to 6 centimeters. This is really the shift from pre and early labor into established labor. Because before that time, before established labor comes in, it can come off and on, go off and on, you know, over nights and days of stopping and starting, feeling like it feel, and then it all have a bit of sleep, and then the next day, or you know, just not predictable. Once we get into established labor, where those contractions are coming much more consistently and longer and stronger, then pretty well it starts to become more predictable, that it's going to keep going. So then talking about that, the language of established labor or active labor. And then as it goes a bit further, let's stay with that before we go to the next point, because somewhere in there, around maybe 2, 3 centimeters, there can be a big shunt of adrenaline come in this sort of pre-laborish, early, pre and early labor, this big shunt of adrenaline where women do crazy things. You know, I think in the it used to be sort of shown that, well, they just do crazy home housework. And I remember myself before I had my second baby, never would see them before, but saw these cobwebs up the top and was climbing up the back of the couch, you know, to reach up and get these cobwebs. I mean, just crazy. So this is the shunt of adrenaline, and adrenaline, you know, drives action in the body, and so it's often called that big shunt of adrenaline at that point in pre and early labor, you know, brings on the nesting urge, the getting the nest ready, and that often gets translated into getting the, well, the home birth or at home or cleaning or something or other like that. So that's a shunt of adrenaline that is part of the normal physiology that hopefully women are, yeah, supported, not climbing up the walls to get the I remember my sister was staying over. She came in and found me. She said, "What are you doing up there?" So anyway, that. Then, as we go on into established labor, 4 to 6 centimeters, starting to get more of a pattern, a consistent pattern, not only the pattern of the contraction itself, starting building, 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 peaking, flowing away, but also the pattern of how close together the contractions and things are coming. And then we move up into around 7 centimetres. This is magic. The magic of 7 centimetres. So much of the birth debriefing, I find that women do not know about the magic of 7 centimetres. So the magic of 7 centimetres, big, strong contractions coming, queen oxytocin doing her work. And then around this point, we have this big shift into endorphins starting to come through. And when the endorphins come through, so let's hold that thought about labour. But maybe for anybody who's listening, maybe they do pound the pavement, run up hills, go to the spin class, do that. They know about endorphins. They know that if you keep working hard enough, they're going to hit that point where the endorphins come in, and then they get their second wind, or they just know that this is, in fact, it's why so many of us go to the gym or get up early in the morning to go out running, because we want that fucking endorphin high.
Absolutely, like the runner's high, when you break through the pain barrier and get this real high sensation.
Yeah, well, this is on tap for women labouring normal physiological childbirth, and it happens around 7 centimetres. It's not happening at 2 centimetres.
Mm.
So when those endorphins come in, a few things happen. One is just that high, but also the endorphins take out the cerebral cortex, because
good.
Yes, us human mammals, we, and particularly contemporary, I mean, the cerebral cortex is so brilliant, so brilliant, but some things it's just useless at, and one of them is about birth. Knows fuck all about birthing. The sooner it's out of the picture, the better. So these endorphin high comes through, takes the cerebral cortex out, slows the mother's brainwaves down, so that in fact the baby's brainwaves and the mother's brainwaves are pretty much in sync with one another. So they go much more internal, much more instinctive, much more into that beautiful exchange with their babies. This is magic, magic, magic. And so many women have no idea that what they're missing out on. And so when that they drop into a much more primal state where they're very much in tune with what their body's needing and how to be with the birth and so on, we're going to talk about something else in a moment, go back to the pain, and I'll relate it to that. But so this big shift when these endorphins come through. Then as we move up through that late first stage, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 centimetres, coming into what's something called, you know, transition, challenging,
mm-hmm.
crazy challenging, endorphins helping. But the thing about endorphins, as well as the that high, when women are deeply endorphined, I mean, they look like they're going to sleep in between contractions. They're in this sort of deep, drunken sort of slumber, it looks like. They sort of rise up out of that, deal with the contraction, and then they sort of drop back down again. They don't really have, like, you, I mean, you don't go talking to their cerebral cortex because you don't want to disturb this. And it's a bit like trying to have a conversation with a drunk person, yeah?
Yeah.
So endorphins, beautiful. Protect, 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 watching the miracle of all of this. She's in a deep slumber. But for those who don't know about this, what they're looking at is thinking, this is an absolutely exhausted woman.
Yeah.
And sadly, so many of the midwives and certainly the obstetricians who work in hospital do not know what normal physiological childbirth looks like and this ebb and flow of energy that's coming from the hormonal story. So, and she has been at it all day since earlier this morning, or didn't have a good night's sleep because she was having some early contractions then. And so everybody can be fooled into thinking she is exhausted. It's a big, strong narrative to say, the poor thing, she's been going at this for ages, blah, 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 and look at it. And look, she can't even string some words together. She can hardly stand up. She's exhausted.
And she's only 7 centimetres. You know, she's got so long to go.
Only 7 centimetres. She is a magic 7 centimetres. She's only 7 centimetres. So because staying with the hormones, if we're letting it unfold normal physiological childbirth, what happens around about that 9-10 centimeters, we then have another big shunt of adrenaline comes through. She wakes up. It's so hilarious when they wake up. Like they like they wake up. Sometimes continuing a conversation that they'd been having like 6 hours ago. Remember one woman we went to home birth and the baby had come a little bit early, so they hadn't quite set up the house and things. And she was having a bit of a, not exactly heated, but a conversation with her partner about, well, you know, we've been through all this. You should know where those babies' clothes is, and because the midwife coming in, and while we went, well, where's the baby's clothes? Where's this? Where's that? Let's get set up. Anyway, like 6 hours later, when she comes out of it with this adrenaline rush that wakes her up, she's turned straight to her partner and said, I told you where those babies were. Anyway, we had sorted it out by then. But so they come back into a more fully conscious space, because for women to stay in that deep internal connection with their babies, they need to know that the baby is born. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes been at some births where women are so deeply in that they're not even aware that the baby's born. So in a supported birth, that's okay, somebody who can be aware and draw her attention to it. But if we're back into primal territory and the mum is giving birth and she doesn't know the baby's born, this is not very safe. So they wake up, they come back into a the cerebral cortex comes back on board, the brainwaves change, and the adrenaline wakes them, and then we're into that sort of pushing urge. And most women, when they're pushing, are very present to their body, very present to their baby, and then of course once the baby's born, very present, and oxytocin is flowing very strongly. Queen oxytocin is flowing very strongly at that point. And then when babies are born, generally everybody is crying, everybody is hugging one another, everybody is, we're all falling in love, which is, I mean, why should it be the prerogative of people who go to raves, who take certain substances, to fall in love with everybody? What did it? It's on tap for us in birth.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's the, it's more complex, Get on to Sarah Buckley's work if you want to know more about complex. But these are some of the big observable shifts and changes that happen with the hormones, that if women knew a bit, if women knew when they're coming up around that 7 centimetres and that it's so intense and that they can't, and people are talking to them about exhaustion and they're feeling exhausted and what have you, that this is a magic moment, and that no, they don't need an epidural so that they can sleep. No, they can be supported to move through that and to trust those hormones. This would be one of the big messages that I talk about lots and would hope. As well as that, I'm on a mission because I've got all these 5 grandkids and I've got skin in the game in terms of what's happening when mucking with vital human mammalian hormonal processes that should be being transmitted in all their glory through normal physiological childbirth, and we are fucking with this big time.
Yeah, and is this where the crisis of confidence comes into play?
Okay. You wish. Crisis of confidence. I mean, maybe a way to think about it. So this is the phys ed teacher in me, yeah? So the phys ed teacher and outdoor adventure facilitator, you know, the abseiling, the ropes course, the this, the that, all of those things. I know, as would most coaches and other physical education teachers or sports, your sports buddies or your gym buddy or whatever, you would know that, that there are pain barriers, that you're wanting to achieve something in terms of your health or well-being or fitness or what have you, and you're going to do any of those things, then there can be a pain barrier. There can also be, if it's sort of outdoor adventure and it's, you know, abseiling down that cliff or what have you, there's just freak out, yeah? So what I understood was that many of us can do all sorts of things with our bodies if we're given the right support to move through these sort of, crisis points, what I've come to call crisis of confidence or pain barriers. It's like there's nothing going wrong. It's just, it's very intense. I'm talking now about, I mean, you could talk about that in, if you're, I ask people who come to my classes, who's been on a fun run? Many people have been on fun runs. Was it fun? No, it wasn't fucking fun. It was fun at the start. It was fun at the end. But no, I don't know where you're living, but in Melbourne, I use the thing of that the fun run starts at the base of Mount Dandenong and the fun run finishes at the top of Mount Dandenong. And there's quite a few twists and turns. And no, it's not fun. It's fun in terms of the achievement, but not every. So bursts are like that. So those points of pain barriers, or what I call crises of confidence, can happen at each of the particular jump up points in the labour where the hormones, so that can be like 1 to 2 centimetres, can be 4 to 6 centimetres, 7 centimetres. It's a big one because of this big shift that's happening. And if women are not supported by people who can know and trust that this is part of the normal story, and if she hasn't had some education before about that, then many of the caregivers don't think about it like this, that it's something to be able to get through. They just think, oh, you're in pain. Well, let's give you the fucking epidural, which will hijack the whole labor. So the crisis of confidence, partners need to know about this, because when women are in crisis of confidence, they can. I mean, think about in your own life, when you're any of us, when we're asked to do something that we don't like in the physical sense, or we can think about it in terms of mentally or undertaking something, we're often in a crisis of confidence, we often get a bit whingy, we get a bit whingy, we regress a little bit back to, we get stroppy, we get like, so women in labor, why shouldn't they just express all these problems? They can get stroppy. We can see the 2-year-old temper tantrum come out. We can see the stroppy teenager just tells everybody to fuck off. All
I'm
these
exhausted. I'm
exactly.
tired.
Whingy, somebody take over, somebody do it for me. All of these things are normal behaviors for somebody doing really strong work with their bodies. So those crises of confidence can be like that. However, in our birth culture, of course, the seduction of the epidural is immense. The cultural mindset is that the epidural is the way to go. So when women are on these moments where they're going to drop more, if they move through a crisis of confidence, they're going to drop more deeply into the intensity and more deeply into the beauty and the wonder and the miracle of normal physiological childbirth. But it's rocky road to get there. And so at this point, then, if you've got nobody who can hold that and can help the mother to just drop in a bit deeper, then the epidural comes in, and then that hijacks the whole of the labor. So these crises of confidence, and of course, when women are in those crises of confidence as well, often they do what I call, they're ringing the circle. They're ringing the circle. And what they're looking for is they're looking for sympathy. That they're looking that it's too hard, it's do this, it's do that. And of course, often partners, or like if women are choosing to have with them anybody in that circle who can be caught into a sympathy loop with her, that's the end of that normal physiological childbirth. Particularly if they're in a hospital. I mean, if they're at home, that's a different story. So yeah, in that first book of mine, I do a lot of talking about all of the ins and outs of around all of that. So that crisis of confidence. So we have to normalize that there are crises of confidence. There are points, just in the same way any of the other physical things that you might want to be having a go at. you get in a groove, but then it ramps up, the spin class, the person who's running the spin class says, no, we're going, now we're going up a hill. Oh, no, not up a hill. Yes, up a hill. Same with women in labor and so on. So that crisis of confidence, it's a very, I get lots of good feedback that that really helps women to reframe, take it out of a medical frame into a frame of the body working strong and hard at peak performance, which is the way that I talk about it.
Yeah, beautiful. That is such a nice way to change that mindset around pain, contractions, intensity, no matter how long you've been laboring for.
Let me just say one more thing. If there's
Yeah.
any partners listening to this, let me just say to them, as I say in any of my workshops and things where I've got the partners there, if you can feel, if she's going into a crisis of confidence and she's starting to do a sympathy number on you and you can feel that you are crumbling into that sympathy, get the fuck out of the room and let somebody who knows how to hold that space just wait outside the door until somebody else has done a bit of work and got her back into her groove. They come back in, but do not get caught in that sympathy loop.
I
Oh, it's like
love
I go
that.
down to Google.
The birth partner, particularly nowadays, is present most of the time, if there is one, and they play a bigger role than what they think they do. It leads me into a question beautifully, because you as someone who's attended over what 1,500 births, and probably more than that, close to 2,000. How does our experience of labor and birth impact postpartum? Yes, for the mother, for the partner. I wondered what kind of trend you see when you see a normal physiological birth and their experience of those early postpartum days.
Well, you see that that falling in love, and which isn't just a mental thing in this regard, because all those hormones are through our prehistory and history and whatever, all those hormones are designed to make the mother bond with and the baby bond with, so that that's that safety mechanism of us, our mammalian heritage, to keep mum and baby in the same sort of energy space, if you like. So we see that if then into the postnatal, that's supported and not disturbed. So that's what we would want. So the mum and the baby are really in tune with one another. And of course, that means breastfeeding and co-sleeping and staying close and so on. So that's what we all would love to see. And of course, pretty well anybody who's at that birth, who's part of the ongoing circle of, family or friendship connections with the baby, if they're at the birth, they're all going to fall in love. So everybody then is attuned to that baby. So that's what we love to see. But of course, if that, I mean, it, with the epidural coming in, then queen oxytocin is out of the picture now. Endorphins are out of the picture now. So, which isn't to say that we can't still fall in love with those babies, because they're pretty well designed to be pretty, they've got their wily ways about how they can entrap us into falling in love with them. But it's like there's not that strong hormonal foundation that's really sitting central to that, that then our behaviors are springing from. So there's that. If the birth has been hijacked by the present birth culture, then often there's episiotomy. There's can be, and I mean, I think I said this at the start. Sometimes, absolutely, any and all of those medical interventions are necessary. Brilliant. And then we have to pick up the pieces after that. Maybe I'll talk about that in a moment. But from the point of view of births where women want to engage with normal physiological childbirth and are hoping for that, to do that work and to, have that normal physiological childbirth and all that hormonal gorgeousness, if that doesn't work out for whatever reason, either because of the hospital routines or because they don't really understand about the pain and the crisis of confidence and so on, and the whole birth gets hijacked by the epidural, then there can be a lot of grief around, as well as the body has to recover, the mother's body. And sometimes, of course, well, babies are missing out big time
Yeah.
around all of that. So, just to say around that, because I mean, the stats are really not good, separate to what I was just saying before about what's happening with Queen Oxytocin. But in terms of, just got them here in front of me. I mean, the elective seizure rate, remember, is 25%. No queen oxytocin in that. But of women who do labor, so that's, somebody do the maths anyway, of women who labor, 80% of them are going to be using medical pain relief. So this is the default, as I was saying before, about being in hospital. Hospitals are about pain relief, blah, blah, blah. So all of those things can interrupt with the hormones. So if we're wanting those hormones, then we need people around who understand this and who can help and support women. And women need to be ideally educated to understand not only the hormones, but from the I mean, I've been around too long, I guess. So I think the childbirth education that is telling women that if they do this bit of this or this or this, it's going to be pain-free is fucking bullshit. And that, you maybe if your first birth is a normal physiological childbirth, second baby, third baby, maybe. But pretty much with the first baby, yes, you need some breathing, you need some skills, you need to be able to, as you were saying before, you know, breathe into your yoga class, breathe into, relax into, move around, be in positions where you're working. You need some skills in sort of breathing, but to think that if you do the breathing right, that it's going to be not going to be a challenge, then what happens then when that doesn't hold true?
Absolutely.
Well, the queen oxytocin out of the picture and the fucking epidural is in. So that would be my take on that. I was going to say, so if the birth doesn't go straightforwardly and all of that hormonal exchange that is like our human mammalian heritage is interfered with, but we want really to offer these babies a pathway into the world which is maximizes their capacity to, you know, to be attuned to oxytocin, opening their hearts, opening them as social beings, and endorphins, then, and this again is Sarah Buckley's work a lot on this on the oxytocin researchers now, are saying, I mean, they're still on the case about tracking queen oxytocin and making that story, but they can see that across the Western world, at least, we are fucking with this such big time that they're also talking about, well, we've got to be filling the hormonal gaps. So filling the hormonal gaps for these babies, if it's not coming through that normal physiological childbirth, first of all, breastfeeding. So that's skin to skin, you know, straight. And we are doing, you know, with the seizures. And I think this is something that is happening, even if it's a ends in a forceps or the in oh, I'm getting crazy. Fucking epidural. I was trying to stay at starting just with the epidural, and it just doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't.
If it's a fucking epidural, if it's forceps, if it's a vacuum, or if it's a seizure or what have you, then we are getting better now, at least getting the mum and the baby together straight away. So this is this first step of filling those hormonal gaps that skin to skin. So the skin to skin, eye contact with mum and baby, then breastfeeding, and then co-sleeping. And of course, we all know co-sleeping is safe when we're breastfeeding our babies. Breastfeeding and co-sleeping go together. If you're not feeding your baby, that's a different story. But all of those things are really bringing that close skin to skin, the hormonal exchange, the brainwave connections, and so on. And so this is another way into, helping those babies come into a place where there's a hormonal story that's unfolding, which will serve them well as the sort of human beings that we would love to have. Sweet, 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 lovely to have playing with my grandkids in the playground.
Absolutely. And supporting that mother, particularly, obviously there's those huge hormonal, the huge hormonal journey during labor and birth that we've spoken about, and then postpartum once we birth the placenta. And in those new, the fresh days afterwards, there's huge hormonal drops, the biggest we'll experience. And that's where we really also need this connection and support and bonding and love and natural oxytocin to set the tone for this journey, for the mother, for the parents together, for the household. I have one final question, and then I'll let you go. I'm very appreciative of your time today. How can, so for our listeners that are wanting to know how we can create an environment that's conducive to a positive birth, whether that's a normal physiological birth or whatever the plan is for them, how can we create such an environment?
Well, if they're certainly if they're wanting to open themselves to normal physiological childbirth, they've got to have somebody around them who trusts normal physiological childbirth and knows that it's possible. And so, in crisis of confidence moments or whatever, they've got something solid to lean into, somebody who can help to support that. And also for normal physiological childbirth, and here's the phys ed teacher. I talk about a birth circuit, yeah? So you need to have a space, particularly if it's a first labor. You're just going to be using lots and lots of different, it's like just a circuit for your health and fitness. Many of us are aware of that. So in terms of labor, you need places where she can stand and walk and stomp, and need stairs that she can go up and down. We need places where she can kneel and lean into cushions or couch or partner's lap, or need somewhere where she can lean. And the toilet, of course, the shower, a tub. Okay, let me say this about tubs. Okay, so again, I was around before water came into birth, in the way we understand it now. And when it did come in, which was really more like the mid to late 80s,
Oh.
what we understood, I mean, I'm sure through generations in probably every continent in the world, women have been in water during labor. Yeah. But in the modern era, after we all went into hospital, water only came in water immersion, I mean, shower, yes. And so on, but in terms of getting into a tub, getting into a pool, really only came in around the late 80s, mid to late 80s. And when it came in particular, not only, but in particular, Michel Odent, who some listening might know his work, and he spoke about it particularly. But what we understood was that the water was a way to enhance the physiology, and that the time to go into the tub was specific to the physiology. And the time, you can imagine, when is the time that is absolute, because it wasn't about comfort, although if you're in a tub, it's going to give some ease from gravity and so on. So it does give some comfort. But the whole idea of being in the tub was not about comfort. The intention of the tub was to get in it at the right time to enhance the drop down into primal territory, the enhancing of the physiology. And the best time for that to happen is at 7 centimeters,
The
around
magic 7 centimeters.
7 centimeters. And that you should not get into the tub before 7 centimeters. No. It's like, like a carrot. Soon, 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 keep it going. 7 centimeters, because, and often women, when they would get in the tub at 7 centimeters, because it would drop them so deeply in that the contractions would get even bigger and stronger, and they want to jump out again. Because, I don't know, stay in there. This is the magic. So I think what's happened with the tub now, here in the birth debriefing, is that the tub is seen as comfort, a comfort measure, losing this connection with physiology. And so often what women are doing is they're using the bath at home, or even the bath at the hospital, to get a little bit further into the labor and then have the epidural. Because the bath, it's not going to be that full measure of comfort that the epidural promises. And if they're thinking about the bath as comfort rather than facilitating deep physiology, is my language making, I'm hoping my language is making something clear here.
It's perfect.
Perfect. So the tub is not about comfort. It offers some comfort and ease of flow and movement, but the tub is around physiology. Occasionally, for a woman having a go at normal physiological childbirth, if she's having a very long, long, slow pre and early labor, occasionally getting in a tub will knock it on the head. It will slow it all down, give her a bit of a break, and then she can come back to it. But generally, no, up around that 7 centimeters or so, going to drop her deeply into that communication with her baby and her primal physiology. This is the magic of the tub. So, yes, want to have a tub.
So support, you want to have your circuit, things like the tub, yes, other things like, TENS machine, birth combs, so anything like that around when, like, when did the TENS machine come in? When did the birth comb come in?
Oh no, we were using the birth combs back then. That
Okay.
they came in the 60s. So this is that whole idea of a second pane. This is
Yeah.
that new, well, it was old, it was known a long time ago, but in fairly recent research is saying, yeah, the second pane. Again, because the second pane is a whole boost of endorphins. And the TENS machine came in, I don't know, it'd be in the 90s.
Yeah, okay.
And the TENS machine seems to be to have taken over things. So all of this, I have a few question marks about the TENS machine.
Do you D tell me? I'm fascinated to hear.
I think it's that in the bigger picture, the idea of women being comfortable in labor is the big mindset.
Okay.
And that is the story of the fucking epidural. So then the TENS machine sits into that picture of, well, keeping me comfortable, as opposed to it being something about a tool that might be used to enable me to stay with normal physiology. It seems to be coming into, well, what are the things that can keep me comfortable? And then eventually it'll be the epidural. That's what I read when I hear all the stories, the birth debriefing. So, yeah, I think
Fascinating.
you asked me another question. I'm just going here, there, and everywhere.
No, this has been great. I think that really paints a picture of yes, all the hormonal things that happen in a normal physiological birth and why, you and others do the work that you do to really support women and families to experience such a birth. But also how, we perceive pain and how we can change our mindset around pain and how we can create an environment that is conducive to a nice, normal physiological birth. So this has been fascinating.
I've got one more thing I have to finish with.
Please.
I think that there are increasing numbers of women who want to have a go at normal physiological childbirth. They are, live in community and in society and so on. And so if they're pregnant and they're showing they're pregnant, they're like a magnet to hear birth stories. Birth stories coming at them all the time. And many of the birth stories that they're hearing, particularly if they're women who declare that they want to have a home birth or they want to have a birth center birth or something or other, these stories are going to come to them. And unfortunately, they're like magnets, they stick. And these are the thank goodness birth stories. that they hear. Well, thank goodness I was in that hospital and they could save the baby. And thank goodness I was there and then they could save the baby. And thank goodness they did that, the forceps, and I could save the baby. And thank goodness they could, thank goodness, thank goodness, thank goodness. Occasionally, I'm in your second baby story and case.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness we do have capacity to do this or do that or do that to make a better outcome for some mums and babies. But when women who are pregnant, and particularly those who want to have a go at normal physiological childbirth, which requires some sort of grounded trust about birth in present culture, if they're bombarded by all these thank goodness stories about this happening and this happening and this happening, what I say to them, if any of them are listening now, what I say to them is just gently, gently, in some way, when stories are coming at you, find out, was an epidural involved in that story? And if an epidural was involved in that story, this is the key. Because once those epidurals come in, regardless of what the mother thought was going to happen in that birth, that whole labor is hijacked. So if they can unpack themselves, knowing that the story about the thank goodness they had to save the baby, because often then when that epidural comes in, we do need to save that baby. So to unpack those gently, gently within their own head, so that they're protecting themselves from hearing all of these stories that compound the idea that birth doesn't work or that modern women can't do it or whatever. That would be just another last.
Probably one of the most important and useful tips that you could provide is something like that, because you're so right. Once you're pregnant, people think that that's the perfect opportunity to tell you all of their stories, whether it's a horrible labor or birth or something traumatic, or, you know, breastfeeding went wrong, or all of all of the things. I don't know how many times I, since being pregnant, now that this is my third, that people come up to me and go, you know what, this is just the best, you know, labor and birth is just the most euphoric, and, you know, you feel so strong. And that's not often I hear that.
Very often, no.
Well, thank you so much, Rhea, for joining me today. I personally have learned so much, and I know our listeners have too. For those that want to learn more, you have two books, Birth with Confidence and Beyond the Birth Plan, both of which are just phenomenal. Where else can people find you? Are you still practicing?
I'm not attending births now, but I still do couples workshops and birth debriefing, of course. And run my training course for birth attendants or doulas and so on. So, yeah. And talking on podcasts whenever anybody will ask me.
Yes. Well, this has been phenomenal. Thank you so much for fitting us in. I know that you did have grandparent duties this year, so I'm very grateful to take a slot of one of your grandchildren today.
Good. Okay. Beautiful to talk with you, Georgia.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode.
If you liked it, leave us a review and follow us on socials. We'd love to hear from you.